This is, in fact, Garbology 102. I thank you all for attending. For those of you who weren't here at 101, it is not a prerequisite. Let me just take 2 minutes to recap some of the things we talked about. First, I was again reminded that garbage and waste disposal is, in fact, not only a complex issue, but a very emotional one and controversial. Some of the kinds of things I tried to discuss were some of what I call the myths about solid waste, and I'll just touch on them very quickly now. One, I made a statement that we may not, in fact, be running out of landfill space, that there is, in fact, in a national sense, let me correct that, I may have left the impression that in localized regions there is plenty of landfill space. On a national level, we have a lot of space that is suitable from a geological, engineering, rainfall, proximity to population centers, is suitable for landfilling, if we so desire, and that in fact the shortage of landfill space is a politically created one. It is not a physical shortage. Secondly, I made the statement that we're not recycling when we set our stuff out on the curb every week. That's only part of it. Remember the little triangular symbol. One side of that little recycling symbol means I'm separating these materials. The second one means somebody's taking it, collecting it, processing it. Third one means somebody's making something useful with it and somebody else is buying it. That's recycling. You've got to go all the way around the triangle to recycle. Otherwise, you are in fact just moving stuff from here to there. The third myth I said talked about was if everybody recycles, then we wouldn't need landfills. Fact of life, you will always need a landfill someplace because there will always be something that cannot be recycled because it's too expensive, it's physically impossible, there isn't enough of it, a lot of reasons, but you will always need a landfill. Myth number four, if I recycle, then I'm saving scarce resources. In some cases, that's probably true, but in a lot of cases, the resources we are saving are not scarce. Glass, for example, is made out of silica sand. It's a very, very common material in the Earth's crust. Okay, aluminum made out of bauxite ore. Bauxite is relatively common throughout the world. It just happens that we don't have lots of deposits of it in this country. This is not to say that it's not a good idea to recycle those materials, but we should not do it under the impression that they are scarce, because not all of them are. Myth number five, when I recycle, I save energy. That's true in some cases. For instance, aluminum. It uses much less energy to take a recycled aluminum can, melt it down, and make a new aluminum can out of it than it is to smelt bauxite ore. Same with glass. But that's not always the case. If we look at recycling, how it's done predominantly in this country at the moment, we have what we call curbside collection. You source separate it, you separate it into different components and put it out in bins or bags at the curb. It's picked up by a second truck. The first truck comes by and gets your garbage. And this is not universal, but it happens this way in many, many cities and counties around this country. And so I contend that we ought to consider the energy used by that second truck and the air emissions. Put that in the equation as well. And we may or may not be saving energy in that case. And can I tell you the exact answer? No, because it depends on how far the trucks drive, et cetera. It's very, very localized and specific to a locality. Another myth I talked about is that every city or county or state should take care of its own garbage. And I contend that that's not a good idea in that if you buy things, they probably come with packaging and you probably throw the packaging away. And the things you buy, most of them are not made where you live, they're made somewhere else. And so you personally have created part of that problem. You have in fact already imported the waste. And by sending waste, say from Pennsylvania to Indiana, for instance, or Ohio, we're just building on what we've already done. And we say that packaging is a way of life here and we could use less of it, but in fact, it'll never go away entirely. So those were some of the myths that I tried to explore or explode. What I'd like to do today is move a little deeper to what I think the relationship of the whole solid waste question is to our faith. And to do that, I'd like to recycle an Advent sermon given by an intern at St. Andrew's Lutheran in Bellevue, Washington in December of 1988. Sarah Hans is now a pastor in Gettysburg, Virginia, and I'm going to read this to preserve her words. In the Gospel of Luke, we hear how the multitudes anticipated the coming of a Savior, a Messiah. Luke describes the people who were in expectation. "What shall we do?" the people asked John the Baptist. These people want to be prepared. At first, they thought they could just get out their family trees, point to all their good relatives to prove to the coming Messiah that they were decent, upright people. They wanted to be able to say, "Grandpa never missed a church service, Grandma always sang in the choir." But John says, "Nope." "What shall we do then?" John says, "Bear fruits that fit repentance." Tomorrow, and recall that this is December 1988, a guest will arrive in our country, Mikhail Gorbachev, and our nation's capital is pulling out all the stops, getting out the crystal water glasses, parades, special police guards. We have no problem answering the question, "What shall we do?" when a government leader comes to be our guest. But what shall we do? How shall we prepare for our Lord's coming? I'm going to share with you a story about a town that anticipated the arrival of the king. It's a story about you and about me and the multitudes of people in expectation. The announcement had gone out through the countryside like news of gold in Alaska. The king was coming. Rumors had flown for days. No one really knew for sure who had started the rumor, but each rumor grew grander and grander, like stories told by those whose lips are loosened with wine. One rumor caught everyone's attention. The rumor had it that the king would visit only a few towns and that the king's ambassador would do the choosing. Someone said that a contest had been declared to determine which town was worthiest for a visit by the king. Soon town councils were meeting throughout the countryside to plan how their particular town could be made worthy of the king's visit. In one town, nine townspeople gathered around a large oak table to design a plan. The policeman, the town singer, the pastor, the gardener, the doctor, the seamstress, the school teacher, the mayor, and the baker were gathered around the table. Each person had her or his own idea about how the town could be chosen worthiest of a visit from the king. The policeman suggested that the town hold a parade and that everyone should dress in matching uniforms to show how orderly and organized they could be. "Kings like parades in order," said the policeman. The town singer suggested a musical presentation to show the ambassador how worthy their town would be for a visit from the king. "How kings love music," the singer said. The pastor suggested that a special plaque be placed on a pew in the front of the church, marking this pew as the king's. "We could hold a special service in the king's honor and show him how we always use his name in our prayers," the pastor said. The gardener suggested that all of the lawns be landscaped. "We could cut all of the bushes into animal shapes and place pots of flowers on every doorstep. Kings love beauty," said the gardener. The doctor suggested that the king could have a white glove tour of the town clinic. "Kings are always concerned about health and cleanliness," said the doctor. The seamstress suggested that flags be made for the king. "Flags would make a king feel most welcome," said the seamstress. The school teacher suggested that the town museum could be opened for the king so he could see the fine, honest, upright history and traditions which the town had. The mayor suggested that a key be made, a larger-than-life key, which could be given to the king. A key will let the king know that he is always welcome in our town," said the mayor. The baker suggested a special king's cake made from the finest ingredients. After several votes, it was decided that each person would carry through with his or her suggestion. The town was busy with excitement, preparing for a king. So much work to be done. Policeman, singer, pastor, gardener, doctor, seamstress, school teacher, mayor, and baker, all set to work. They felt sure that their town would prove worthy for a king's visit. As I said earlier, this town had 10 people, but only 9 were present at the town meeting. Missing from the meeting was Joshua. Joshua had shown up in town a couple of summers back. His hair looked rather like a straw bird's nest, and his clothes were so worn that they almost looked shiny in places. Thoughts often got confused in Joshua's head, so that some people called him slow or mentally ill. The townspeople ignored Joshua as he kept to himself in the old shed behind the church. No one knew how he survived, although no one really cared. What they didn't know or didn't want to think about was that Joshua often went into the storage sheds of the townspeople and poked at their garbage. Busier and busier, the 9 other townspeople became as the rumored day of the ambassador's decision drew close. Would their town be worthy in the ambassador's eyes for the visit from the king? Hustle, bustle. About face, forward, right. King of kings, let us pray. Snip, snip, scrub, scrub, stitch, stitch. Page 1, page 2, vroom. On this honorable occasion, sift and mix, sift and mix. All were the sounds heard. Da-da-da-da, sang out the ambassador's horn. The townspeople woke up, sluggish with sleep. But it's so early. But here's the ambassador to see if we are prepared for a royal visit. Jumping from their beds, the townspeople dressed and went out to greet the ambassador. Because of the early hour and unexpected arrival of the ambassador, the trash cans of every townsperson stood before their gates. My, what a surprise, said the ambassador. In every town I've visited so far, I've seen parades, heard concerts, listened to prayers, been surrounded by flowers, marveled at doctors' medical instruments, seen flags and banners, ancient ancestors, been put to sleep by speeches, and have been bombarded with sweet cakes and cookies. Not ever before have I been shown a town's garbage. Please, please explain these items before your gates. The people were too surprised and embarrassed to make up fancy lies, so they simply told the truth. In front of the policeman's gate was a box of torn up valentines and unanswered letters. Love doesn't fit into the order of things, said the policeman. Love is silly and sentimental. That's why I tore up these valentines and never answered these letters. In front of the singer's gate were the black pieces of several records. I couldn't stand to hear someone singing more beautifully than I, so I broke these records, never to listen to them again. In front of the gardener's gate, the trash can was topped with several birds' nests. These nests were clogging up the branches of bushes I was snipping, so I tossed them out. In front of the doctor's gate, the can was full of crumpled paper. Those papers, said the doctor, are all the tests I cheated on to get A's. Everybody cheated, he said. In the can before the seamstress gate lay pieces of cloth, plenty enough to patch a few holes and make a jacket. The seamstress said, I was tired of seeing the material after making so many flags, and I simply threw it out. Topping the trash at the schoolteacher's gate was a single yellow piece of paper. This town, the teacher said, began as a hiding place for thieves. I did not want the museum to display any evidence of our early history, so I threw this document out. In the trash can before the mayor's house was a receipt showing the huge cost of having the key to the city gold-plated. I wanted to make a great impression, said the mayor. The baker's can contained several cakes. Those are samples of king's cake. I did not like how I iced them, so I threw them out. Now the ambassador and the townspeople stood in front of the church. The pastor smiled a little smugly to himself, as everybody noticed that there was no trash in front of the gate to the church. No sooner had he smiled than Joshua came walking from the shed to the church. Who is this man? The ambassador asked the pastor. Who is this man who lives in the shed behind the church? The pastor, usually so quick to speak, said nothing, for he didn't know that anyone was living in the shed and didn't even know Joshua's name. No, sir, I don't know this man, said the pastor, staring first at Joshua, then at the shed, and then at the path Joshua had made from the shed to the church, but which, for some reason, the pastor had never even noticed before. At that moment, the ambassador, with a deep bow, said, This is the king for you have for whom you have prepared. This is Joshua. In other towns, the people prepared for a king to whom they could give an honorary larger-than-life gold-plated key to the city. They didn't expect that the king was one of the homeless. In other towns, the people prepared for a king for whom they could bake cakes. They didn't expect that the king was one of the hungry. In other towns, people prepared for a king to whom they could give flags. They didn't expect that the king's clothing needed patching and that his jacket was threadbare. In other towns, the people prepared for a king who would love artistically snipped bushes. They didn't expect a king who would care even about the tiniest birds. How well you have prepared by putting your trash out for the king. Sarah adds a footnote that the one whose birth we anticipate now at Holden this summer and Christmas in July, the one whose birth we celebrate and anticipate will be born to be crucified for our sin upon a real trash heap called Golgotha. Amen. I'd like to switch gears now and try to provide some of the kinds of information that I think people were seeking last night. These are not in any particular order, but I'd suggest them as approaches to solid waste solutions, to action that we can take. First, act out of concern, not out of fear. I think we should exercise because we think it's good for us and we feel good about doing it, not because we're afraid of dying of a heart attack. I think we should do something about waste disposal because we are named and called to be stewards of a creation, not because we're afraid of the consequences that might happen if we don't do something. People say, well, what's the right solution? What should I do to protect the environment? I might compare that to saying, doctor, if a person doesn't feel good, what should he or she do? The solutions are always very particular and very specific to the exact situation. There are no global solutions that work in every time and every place. Every solution has to be individual. It has to fit the context, the physical environment where the action is to take place, the economic conditions, the desires of the community. Third, keep an open mind. There's no single, timeless, forever and ever solution to environmental problems. Fourth, search for a solution and continue searching. Situations change and the answers change. Avoid treating technology as an idol. Technology supplies the means of accomplishing, in the short run, that which the vocal part of our society says it wants. A frightening example occurred to me this morning, the atomic bomb. And I don't know whether it was the president or the Congress or the citizens of this country decided that the war had to end immediately in a catastrophic way that would keep the Japanese from fighting, continuing to fight. Scientists and engineers did not develop the bomb necessarily because they thought it was the right solution. Society, or some portion of society that was in control, in command, ordered them to do that. This is not to excuse any of us, especially us as engineers and scientists, from responsibility. But I would suggest that the responsibility belongs to all of us, and that we as scientists should not allow ourselves to be put in the position of dictating or telling each of you that this is the right solution. What our calling, I think, should be is to suggest what the impacts of your desired action are and to help you put people and equipment and land and water and electricity together to make things happen. But we should not be dictating to you whether they are right or the best or even the better choice. That's a responsibility each one of us has as individuals. I talked about solutions not being transient, not being forever and for being universal. We have a concept in this country that recycling is when you set it out at the curb. That is not the only way to recycle. There are lots of other ways, and if we were to take even a more global approach and to go to Europe and find out that that's not necessarily how it's done there. There are lots of ways of doing this. We just have to give ourselves some direction as what we're trying to achieve. We should be conscious, I think, of the resources we're using. We should be respectful of them. There was a movie a few years back called The Gods Must Be Crazy. It was about a family in the Kalahari Desert. And I recall that the Bushman, the main character in it, apologized to some animal before he killed it. He said, "I'm really sorry, but I have a family I must feed." I believe that there are similar traditions among the American Indians. I think it's important to think about the resources we use. This is a beautiful building. It's made out of wood and other resources. And I think it provides some wonderful things for us. We can't do without cutting trees to make this a building like this. But we should be respectful of that tree in whatever incarnation it's at now. Some part of that tree is still with us here. And we, at least at some times, ought to remember that and treat that memory with respect. Another way or another approach to solid waste is that we could act as servants to one another. We could pick up each other's trash. This is Holden Village, and yet we'll find litter, we'll find coffee cups that haven't been taken back to the kitchen. A servant-like attitude might make the whole recycling thing go a lot easier. I think it's important to teach our children, to give them the tools to think and to struggle with difficult decisions, to ponder. I think we're also called to listen to our children. If they can figure out how to open childproof bottles, then they certainly can help us figure out how to deal with our waste. We need to allow our children enough freedom to innovate, to try out their ideas, and to fail if necessary, and to triumph if at all possible. The future, I think, of solid waste management belongs to the Scotts and Allisons, Allie and Chelsea, Nathan and Tyler, Aaron and Alyssa, our children. And I believe that it's important for us to give them the tools and the freedom to help us as adults learn how to approach this problem. And last, but next to last, I think we need to do this with a sense of humor, a sense of lightheartedness. I think we have a tremendous amount of hubris, of pride, probably wrongful pride, that we are so powerful that we could actually destroy God's creation. I don't think we're big enough or strong enough or even dumb enough to do that. I believe that we play an important role, but the world does not hinge, I don't think, on our actions. And so I ask that we step back from this waste disposal problem occasionally and say, well, yes, I actually threw that can in a garbage can instead of taking it through a recycling center. I think that's permissible. I think it reflects on the brokenness of this world. I think it reflects on our role in that we are not called each individually to save the world in a major way, but only in small steps, and to keep that in proportion. I'd like to point out that if we in fact believe we put our money where our mouth is, that waste disposal costs anywhere from $40 to $200 a ton for typical municipal garbage. Reflect that typical breakfast cereal costs about $3 a pound or $6,000 a ton. Where are our priorities as determined by our wallet. I'm not contending that we should pay $6,000 a ton to handle our waste and $45 a ton for cereal, but just to occasionally step back and put things in perspective. And last, I think we're called to go out with good courage, to have faith that we've been given gifts by our God, not only the creation, but we've been given mental and physical tools in our bodies and our minds to deal with this kind of problem. And I truly believe that we have a God who loves us and I hope laughs at our mistakes occasionally. There is hope out there. And I would ask that we all go out from this place with faith and with courage and hope to do what we believe is right, even if right is only for this moment, not for next year, not for the year after, not for our grandchildren, but only for this moment, because that may be all we're capable of. That's my sincere hope for all of you. I am very consciously dodged giving specific technological solutions to specific problems, partly because I do that 5 days a week. It's my career, it's my intellectual stimulation. I'd be happy to go into those now, but I thought that because this is, in fact, Holden Village, we have to look at some of the other things that I think surround our decision-making and our action. So with that, we're open for questions.
In a comment last night about recycling many years ago, when I was a kid, my dad had raised chickens, and we used to buy chicken feed 100-gallon Pizzex. They came in cotton cloth, printed cloth with bags. My mother would then take and split open, wash, and make my sister's clothes, my clothes first. They were all from recycling packaging.
Sure.
I mean, nothing was it.
That's right. And if we could recover from any anxiety or embarrassment we might have in wearing such clothes, we would. Maybe it's time to start up with that again. One thing somebody pointed out last night is recycling is not the only tool we have. We have waste reduction, not making the waste in the first place. And we talked about packaging and buying things that are made out of recyclable materials and all that are recycled. Let me correct myself, recycled materials. There are lots and lots of solutions or techniques or things we can do. And again, I throw that out to us and our children to develop those things, to come up with those ideas. We, as professionals, while we might think we know a lot, we certainly ought not to feel that we know everything. There are great ideas waiting to be born among you, your children, your grandparents.
I just heard this story about the Henry Ford, and they first designed for the model. He ordered batteries from a battery making company. He designed the packaging, the boxes, very carefully. Mentioned the boards very carefully. Found out later that what he was doing, he was using those boards for floorboards. They just get right to the car.
So from that, we can either decide that that's a great story of reuse, or that's a story about packaging not made for a certain, made for another purpose. Pardon me?
That might be an idea that we haven't thought of for a long time anyway, is to make packaging that can be used for another purpose that's very specific, right?
I think that's a good point, and that will come about when people write to a company and say, I love your product and I will continue to buy it, but only if you would consider doing such and such a thing. I think that's important. I mentioned last night my dismay that we as a country are held hostage by one or two or three people that tampered with Tylenol however many years ago. And I understand that not all that packaging is there to protect us, and I'm not saying that I advocate doing without that. But here's a case of packaging for a reason which is kind of a despicable reason. And I don't know how we change society to do that. I don't know if we can ever go back.
Wonderful.
Okay, now let me put back on my technology hat for the way I do things 5 days a week. The traditional garbage truck that you see coming down your street is what we call a compactor truck. A large part of the weight of that truck is in a compacting mechanism, and it does take bags and squish them down. Now, one of the problems with squishing down recyclables is you tend to break the glass. And it's a well-known fact that in a materials recovery facility, MRFs in the trade, or what you might call a recycling center, where they take all the recyclables and process them, pickers will not sort broken glass by color. Now, to recycle glass, we have to, in general, put all the clear together, all the brown, and all the green to, you know, separate those. If you break the glass, it all goes out as residue to a landfill. And so one reason not to throw it all in a packer truck is that you will break the glass. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a truck that hasn't been designed yet or invented yet that could handle this. One of the problems we have is in recycling trucks, there are trucks that have 3 or 4 or 5 bins. You can order as many as you want. And then the driver or his helper ends up dumping all the glass in one, the aluminum in another, the plastic in one, newspaper. Oh, well, that's only 4. Well, what if you want to take junk mail? Hey, there's a lot of that. Or milk bottles, or. And suddenly now you've got a truck that's a block long, and now you need a lot of people. And you say, that's a dumb solution to have 2 trucks. I agree, but try and find a state or a city in this, I guess I shouldn't blame states. Cities and counties are doing that all over the place with 2 trucks. And part of what I was trying to trigger last night in people's mind was a questioning of whether source separation, curbside collection, is in fact a good way or a better way to do it. As I proposed was to allow everybody to participate, you could still separate things, and maybe you could put containers, which often contain liquid in them, residue, in one bag, blue bag, so it's easily identifiable, and newspapers in another. One of the problems we hear about mixing everything together is the broken glass gets into the paper, and then it degrades the quality, and it's much harder to reprocess at a mill. And that's, you know, for the most part, correct. So you might, a system might be to have a blue bag for containers and a blue bag for paper products, and toss that into the truck with the rest of the garbage. Now, it'll be compacted, and some of that glass will break, but if you put it in there with plastic bottles and aluminum cans, they will take up some of the crushing force, and not all the glass will be broken, at least theoretically. If you were to take this whole truck, now a single truck, because it's the same stuff that started before we did all the source separation, goes to a plant, and it's dumped on the floor, and the blue bags are pulled out visually. They're easy to identify. They go a part of the plant that would have been the MRF, the recycling part, in a traditional facility. And the rest of the garbage goes through another kind of process line, and I don't know what to suggest at the moment, but there are lots of technologies out there for sorting what we call raw garbage and taking out more of the elements that were thrown away, because there always will be tin cans or glass or aluminum or newspaper thrown away in the general garbage bin. Now that, to my way of thinking, is one potential solution. Has it been tried in this country? Not really yet. But that goes against the grain of what we see in this country. In most states, laws say you must have separate curbside collection. Doesn't say you can commingle it. And so we've dashed down a road towards the goal of recycling in a way because we thought that it was important to make all of us feel good that we were doing our part. That doesn't have to go away, but I contend that that's a very narrow focus and that we need to go to the next step.
The solution is possible. On everything. Put a dollar bottle deposit or a dollar a can like that, they would get back to the store, they get back recycled, and some of them would have. The people that go shopping take the stuff back with them when they go to the empty trunks, they go shopping, bring back other stuff, and come back.
There's force of issue in some places because when you take them back, what is the grocery store supposed to do with them? I then they have to have a place to store and to sort and so on, and you know, they don't want to be bothered either.
Well, that's their problem. You know, it's our problem. That's what you really solve. Now you have sorting, now you have everything all done for you. No second truck. No extra trips. Just go back to store.
That would be a tremendous waste of energy. You know, unless you, you do that in the right way, that is, if you bring that stuff back at the time you're buying groceries, and you don't do it, that's a separate conference to the fee.
Well, you know, when you go this way, you come to me and you're almost full.
When you're for an earthly activity with my students, I had them all try to take something that was in garbage. They had to identify from their garbage. And they could recycle it into something else that was useful. It was kind of a problem solving, creative kind of thing. And it was kind of fun to see the things that they thought to do with 2 liter bottles and bed curtains and so on. But what was really interesting was the reaction of some of the students that said, yeah, but would it be something if you didn't have them in the first place? I mean, it's one thing to say, well, I can make work your garbage, but what if you had not? So how could you not even generate? And it became really a really great thing that we've been doing ever since with. How can you become less consumer? Like, I think a lot of my students' parents are back to the straight bag. They go shopping, they don't take those sacks. When they go through the wall, they have no bag. Aware.
No, just let me point out something about consumerism. There is an element that has, you know, certainly a lot of consumerism isn't necessary, but I think there is a lot that has been very helpful to us also in the following sense. To take one area that I'm aware of, the area of communication. You could imagine that certainly a consumer product is a television, a telephone, a computer, almost any device like that you can think of as a consumer product. And those products have been very beneficial in many ways. And so, I was talking about those new ways because I think that that would be something that you need to think about yourself. So there is that aspect of technology and its benefits, and there are, as part of consumerism. And so there's this tension, again, that we've talked about, there's a tension between the consumerism, the products, and what they've done for us, and what they haven't done for us. I see that kind of tension always within the business. And, you know, certain area, something that I have to continue to think about. But not all consumerism is bad. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Just as you do the same thing again.
Yeah.
I mean, we just remodeled the kitchen, and we haven't bought new appliances for so long, I did not know about the new locks. You know, and who wants a 21-year-old dishwasher? That'd be nice. So what do you do with it?
Well, remember when I said you almost need a landfill?
Exactly. But, you know, they charge in Minnesota, they tax you extra to put them in landfills. You pay an extra fee to send them.
And that's probably a good idea, and that's why you don't buy a new one every year. Somebody has got a similar machine, and I in this country, but I've been very disappointed. I've never seen one. That are just sort of a reverse vending machine kind of thing. And I think that's a good, it's one of the solutions. It's one of the aids or actions we could take. If and I'm not talking down to anybody, that if that's a good way to teach your kid how to do it or why. I mean, the money incentive probably doesn't mean much to most adults, But I think that's an excellent way of making us aware. Again, it's part of a whole spectrum of kinds of things we could be doing. I was hoping to dodge that because I've read papers that say that are both pro and con deposit bills. So that's a very controversial thing, as she mentioned over here. If I can make an attempt at sort of the pros and cons, one is it is more work, certainly for the supermarket, and the way it works is that the supermarket gets part of, you pay a deposit when you buy the cans, a six pack of pop, for instance, and you only get back a certain amount when you turn the can back, and the store keeps part of the difference, in the state or the county keeps the rest for environmental programs. Unfortunately, it only deals with certain kinds of items. You probably, if you live in a deposit state, taking something back and they go, oh, we don't take that. We're at a picnic recently and somebody was collecting all the pop cans in Michigan, or say 10 cent deposit. And then there were some fruit juice cans that were aluminum and something else. And they threw those away, canned iced tea. But they didn't have that stamped on the top. There was no deposit, so they threw them away. So you couldn't probably take that back to your grocery store, even though it was going to a recycling endpoint. The grocery store would say, wait, we don't take those. So
that's all in the contract or going law?
Probably both. I don't know.
Certainly kind of flaw in the law.
Well, in
I would suggest it was either grocery deposit or everything.
Well, then should we just have a value added tax? Oh my God, I don't want to get into that. Well, everything comes in a container, doesn't it?
That you get a big deposit back, and you take it back to where you buy it. You will take it back.
I'm not even going to touch people's consumer habits.
That's a myth to me. I think that most people can't afford to make deposits, and they can get the money back and take it back to you.
I guess the problem, the flaw, if there is one in that thinking, is that it's going to control a major portion of our waste. It will control some of it, and I guess I'm open to arguments on both sides, personally, as far as deposit or no deposit. It's not going to change what I was going to do with that aluminum can anyway. I mean, me personally, but I can't say that for each one of you. I can't say that for everybody else, because each of you makes a decision, not once in a lifetime, but every single time you pick up something.
I've been from LA to Las Vegas several times, up across from Mojave Desert. And it's littered millions of cans and bottles. Nobody wants them, they won't give them up. But they're worth $1 a piece. They would be gone.
Let me throw out one of the arguments against deposits coming back to me now is that, wait a minute, why did somebody throw it out on the highway? Now, we're not talking about in a trash container. We're not talking the difference about throwing it in a trash container versus on the highway. But that's a whole different kind of, I mean, that's exactly right. And a deposit or not deposit will not keep a person who is willing to toss it out the window, will not keep him from tossing out the window.
If you pick it up again, though, it's worth something.
That's one of those philosophical, I'll put on my engineer's hat and say I'm not qualified to debate. Oh, I dropped that thought. One of them is, as Glenn alluded to, that takes space. These are not reasons not to do it, but you've asked what would be some drawbacks. It takes space in the store. It will require more employees, which, if we're in a recession, that might be a great thing to have. On the other hand, it might not be. So we would create jobs, and depending on how you look at things, if you're willing to pay extra for every loaf of bread and every carrot you buy in the store because now there are more overhead people, if you will, in the store, that would be. That's correct. And it
very serious.
Remember how stores or supermarkets, let's just talk about supermarkets here, shelf space, you know, was sold by the foot to Procter & Gamble or Duncan Hines or whoever. Okay, now you've got a big area, and I'm not, again, saying that you shouldn't do it, but Now you have to have a room or an area for accepting deposits. You have another cash register. You have another place to store. How many kinds of things would you like to take back? 2-liter pop bottles, aluminum cans? Would you like to make them steel cans? Okay, those could be drawbacks. And again, I do believe that to a large extent, in many commodities, the poor pay the most because they can't afford the economy of scale. They can't afford to buy it. If you've got 50 cents in your pocket, you can probably buy a can of pop in most places. It'd be much cheaper to buy a 2-liter bottle, but that might be 99 cents on sale. And if you only got 50 cents in your pocket and you're thirsty, I think you buy the single can. There are all these kinds of conflicting things, and if you leave here with nothing other than a sense of hope in your heart, I hope you get some inkling that these are very complicated decisions. They're not universal, and you have to be very specific about where you're talking about and then what your goals are. So I think we've seen some drawbacks to these deposits and a lot of benefits. Then the next question is, why don't more of us have deposits, bottle or container deposits? And I don't know the answer to that.
Why can't you buy pop anymore because of pop? At least we can't believe it. I think stores refuse to sell it, given a choice of cans or Pepsi bottles that they had to come back and recycle. The store said, I'll sell Pepsi in cans because, sure, they don't have to have just all the point you make.
They don't have to have bottles on there.
Exactly.
They want bottles.
And we, the consumer, encourage them because
that's correct.
It's just incredible, the difference. You save a tremendous amount of energy, which means that you're not using as much energy, you're not polluting as much. And so that's another part of the cycle that you want to look at. I don't know how it compares to glass. I can't remember.
The thing was made that you can use a glass container 7 times. That's equivalent to using a container once. And most glass containers are good.
But Lord knows what happened. But Lord knows what the comparison is when you consider trucking around a Coke bottle versus a Coke can in terms of weight. And I don't know what the answer is.
You know, about 15 years ago, there was a great move to ban the can in Minnesota. That debate went on for about 3 years. As he mentioned, the lobbyist came up. My brother worked for Coca-Cola at the time, and they spent $1 million getting that can accepted and the bottle eliminated. So you're working with a complex issue.
Remember that lobbyists are representing somebody, and indirectly representing all of us who buy their products. We don't want to pay $15 for a can of Coke. And if Coke can sell Coke cheaper by putting an aluminum can or a plastic bottle or a glass bottle or whatever and keep us buying it, then that's what they will do. There are no evil third parties out there polluting the planet. It's all of us. Well, I can tell you the price of everything in that store will go up because now you've given the waste disposal problem. Remember what I said last night? NIMBY is fine. Leave it in the store in their backyard. Remember the evil twin, Pitby? You're putting it in, if you don't put it in my backyard, you're putting it in their backyard. And someday that'll come back to haunt all of us. And so that's what makes these things complicated. What's good for me personally, economically, might be very bad for everybody else. I heard somebody last night say something about, oh, well, we really minimize our garbage and I take it over to what's left and take it over and put it in the church dumpster.